Hey everybody, welcome to this week's OIG Roundtable, episode 99. Delivered right to your inbox and LinkedIn, episode 99. Coming up on episode 100 next week. We're looking forward to seeing what everybody has in store for our 100th consecutive episode. The podcast has morphed from retro fraud all the way through to the OIG Roundtable, and so we are coming up on episode 100. But for today, episode 99, I've got Wade McFall, assistant special agent in charge, parentheses, retired from the OIG, and one of our managers on our SIU team, and Matt Kachansky, former HHS OIG executive and the former Northeast UPIC director and our payment integrity director here. So today we want to talk about, there was a press release that came out regarding Teva Pharmaceuticals. And for those of you that aren't familiar with Teva, they are a generic manufacturer of drugs. They're the largest generic manufacturer of drugs in the country. And they recently entered into, I just looked it up, this is now their third lawsuit settlement in as many years, basically, 2022. 2023, and then this one this year, and we'll talk a little bit about them, but they just entered into a $250,000 civil settlement relative to kickbacks and false claims for copay and coupon assistance, and we'll talk a little bit about that as we get through this. You know, the big thing with copays and coupon assistance in the Medicare, Medicaid, government payer space, you cannot use those coupons and those copay assistance programs. It is considered to be a violation of the anti-kickback statute, but it can be used in the commercial space. And by that, we mean that the instances in which, you know, you see the commercial on TV and it says, if you're having trouble paying for blah, 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 the pharmaceutical company can help you. You can have as little as a zero copay. And that's because of these coupon copay programs that originate oftentimes through patient assistance foundations, or sometimes what they call PAF. And those are organizations that are dedicated to helping with large amounts of money that may be owed for medications. And what happens is these coupon and copay assistance programs are charities, and the pharmaceutical industry donates money to them. And the money is supposed to be fungible, meaning it's just supposed to go into a pot and it's used. But that's not typically what happens, is that oftentimes what investigators are identifying is that most, if not all, of the money that's going into the foundation is coming from one pharmaceutical company. And so therefore, the pharma company is using the patient foundation, this charity organization, essentially as a surrogate for the submission of circumventing this process. Because unlike the coupon and copay programs, these charitable foundations can exist and can work to offset costs in the Medicare and Medicaid space. And that's where the problem arises, is that when you're really just using it to fund one drug. And there have been a number of studies that have talked about things relative to the fact that the use of coupon and copay programs can increase the cost of drugs nationally, because the coupon and copay programs are only for copays and the like relative to name brand drugs, not generics, which obviously create a huge reduction in cost for the patient, including copay encumbrance and the like. So there's an argument that the use of coupon and copay programs actually increases the cost of healthcare because patients are steered specifically into the name brand of the drug when a generic is otherwise available. So not looking to make an economic argument over this, but we want to talk a little about Teva, talk a little bit about the investigative considerations. But the first thing is that what people tend to not really maybe pay attention to, and we've talked about this a little bit, is this whole premise of district shopping, and how lawyers will oftentimes, with QI-TAMs, will oftentimes shop a case to a district that is typically a little bit more friendly. And, you know, obviously whether rulings come out that create this chilling effect. Now, last week I was on a podcast with Sean Weiss at The Compliance Guy and Ronald Chapman, who's a criminal defense lawyer. And we talked about QI-TAMs. We talked about the chilling effect. So you can go and look at that podcast. But wait, I want to talk about this because it's an important piece from that investigative, that QI-TAM perspective, is that in a district like Boston, they, for many, many years, have gotten the lion's share of QI-TAMs relative to the pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, we've talked a lot about this on podcasts, this whole premise of shopping your case to the appropriate district. And in the QI-TAM space particularly, because there's money that's involved. Oftentimes, these cases go to the districts that do the most of them. And then what winds up happening is they become very conversant in doing those cases. They become very conversant at those civil settlements. But it does always beg the question of, you're in California and you have a QI-TAM in Boston, like, you know, like the benefits, the risks, but also the collateral piece is that you really do burden a U.S. attorney's office, an OIG office with that. And so, you know, all of those resources then become taxed even greater. So it is a consideration on choosing to shop a case.
Yeah, definitely. And we talked a little bit before we started recording that kind of the reasons why the Boston, you know, U.S. attorney's office and Boston in general became kind of the mecca of primarily pharmaceutical QI-TAMs. I mean, there's QI-TAMs obviously throughout the country, and there's pharmaceutical QI-TAMs throughout the country, but probably, and I tried to find a number online and I couldn't, but I would guess it's somewhere in the 90-95% range of pharmaceutical QI-TAMs that are filed in Boston. And a lot of the different reasons go towards that, but generally it's because they've been doing them for so long. So now you have not only the area has a lot of QI-TAM attorneys who are very experienced. They can, you know, put their record up on their website, and we won this many QI-TAM cases equating to this many dollars. The judges are used to this type of cases. The U.S. Attorney's Office, they're used to working these cases. Frankly, the agents in the area probably have worked more pharmaceutical QI-TAM cases than other parts of the country. And I think we'll probably get into this part eventually on this podcast, but the other part is the relators in Boston have a lot more experience. A lot of them are, they've done it for a couple different cases, or they're from the big companies that are like repeat offenders, for lack of a better word. But, you know, it started out years ago when these cases became popular, where Boston had like a little bit more than the rest of the country, but because of the ongoing, you know, the number of cases that have been there, it's just like the experience, they become the subject matter expert in pharmaceutical. And again, there are QI-TAM cases throughout the country and different firms that represent relators, but Boston really has become the subject matter expert, especially in pharmaceutical health.
Yeah.
Healthcare in general, maybe not as much in Boston, but as far as the pharmaceuticals, it's really become the mecca of it.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. We would joke in New Jersey about the I-95 corridor for QI-TAMs in the pharma space, because they would start in Boston. And if Boston was too busy, you know, sometimes lawyers have good relationships with the U.S. attorney's offices, and they know, hey, if you bring this case to Boston, we're not going to be able to work it. We're going to decline it. So, you know, it's like you go Boston, you go New Jersey, you go to Philly. Those were kind of you were just getting the car with your binder and just drive from Boston to District of New Jersey to Philly to see these cases. And, you know, oftentimes when they came to New Jersey, the relator's attorney would say, they were open. Hey, we shopped this to Boston and Boston declined it, but they declined it because of resources. They didn't decline it for another reason. So, you know, it becomes part of that metric that you have to think about when you're shopping a case. And that's why I think for people that are working in the SIU space, you have to think sometimes in terms of out of that box. Like the fact that a provider may be located in New Jersey, you might actually have investigative venue in other places. For example, where are the checks processed? Where are the claims sent? Is there a wire fraud? And wire fraud, it has to be interstate, has to cross state lines. For mail fraud, it can be intrastate within the state. But the key thing to remember is if you have a provider in New Jersey, but the claims are submitted to a payer that's in some place other than New Jersey, you've got a potential venue. You can discuss that case with people in places other than just in your backyard. But Matt, I want to, you know, we doing some research for today's recording. This isn't Tava's first rodeo. So in June of 20, not to go back historically on everything involving Tava, but in June of 2022, they settled a $420 million lawsuit out of Connecticut, in which Tava was sued by a bunch of unions for price manipulation, in which the price of certain generic drugs grew by 1,000% on the formularies for a bunch of these unions. So there was a 2022 case involving that. What's interesting about that is when I was at the OIG, I did a case involving a company called First Data Bank and McKesson. And First Data Bank was publishing, there were two books that were out there. One was the Red Book, and then one was the First Data Bank book. And those were supposed to be the AWP, the average wholesale prices that were listed. Now, the Red Book did the average wholesale price that the manufacturer told them. It's basically the sticker price of a car. And what First Data Bank touted was that what they did, allegedly, was that they solicited the top 10 or 12 wholesalers and took an average price of that, and they did, like, they claim that they had some weighting that went on because you had a wholesaler like McKesson much bigger than a wholesaler like H.D. Smith, for example, right? So they did this weighting to come up and show it. The truth of the matter is that at the end of the day, the only wholesaler that actually provided pricing information was McKesson. And McKesson knew that the other wholesalers weren't providing that data, so McKesson artificially inflated the price of certain drugs by 5% on average. And while it didn't just benefit McKesson because it was across the board, the fact is that at the time, I believe there were 46 states that had written into their Medicaid laws that pricing was going to be an average wholesale price or AWP off of the First Data Bank data. So there was this inherent manipulation in that pricing. And so I bring that up because the Teva case kind of made me think of that because it was very similar in this manipulation. But we've got in 2022, $420 million. 2023, they were part of the multi-district litigation involving the opioid crisis and paid out $193 million. Now there they paid $193 million. I think it was over, it's going to be over 20 years or something like that. But $193 million. And then just last week, they did this $250 million case, and I believe that the 2023 civil settlement included a corporate integrity agreement, and then they've got this one. Now, obviously, the argument is going to be that the corporate integrity agreement was for different things than this, but, you know, you talked about on last week's podcast, I believe, or at least in the past couple of weeks, this premise of too big to fail. And, you know, that you're so big. And, you know, the question is that, you know, there's no deterrent factor. This is the price of doing business when you're the largest company, when you have a blockbuster drug, you know, on the name brand market where you're making $1 billion or $2 billion. The question is this just the price of doing business? And corporate integrity agreements clearly don't change behavior. Prosecutions don't change behavior. We're not going to terminate them or exclude them from participation because that would have a really negative effect on the American healthcare system from pricing, from availability of drugs and things of that sort. So it's like, what do? We just keep going back to the well and just, you know, at some point I joke with people, I go, these manufacturers should just hand their checkbooks to the government. And whenever the government finds something, just let the government write the check because that's what, you know, just continues to happen.
Yeah, it is the same old story with, you know, these very large healthcare entities, you know, whether they be a pharmaceutical manufacturing company or hospital chains or nursing home franchises, you can't shut them down. I mean, you know, you can't put a company in jail. They may sacrifice some mid-level managers that made some decisions or were told to make some decisions. You can't exclude them from Medicare and Medicaid because there's, as you said, access to care issues. There's access to drugs. And with the drugs, with pharmaceutical companies, it is the, you know, the drug pricing stuff. I mean, if you lose, a Bristol-Myers Squibb and whatever patent drugs they have out there right now, that could completely disable the, you know, complete arms of medicine that utilize those drugs if they're not available anymore. So those, you know, those types of deterrent effect remedies are off the table.
And so what do you have left? Well, and then it's particularly the case if you have a drug that's under a patent and there is no generic. And what if it really is a blockbuster life-saving drug and you go and you exclude the manufacturer of that, right? Because it's, you know, you can't submit or cause to be submitted a claim. And so if you've excluded a drug that's made by a manufacturer that is not generic, you really do have an increased healthcare access, public healthcare crisis.
Correct. Yeah. So, you know, so what are the remedies you have in place? You have civil remedies, and to make an impact there, you really have to know how much money these companies are making from these drugs or these services that they're providing. And the Department of Justice, they kind of get wide-eyed when they're presented with the books and they say, you know, this is the loss, and the company will come back and say, well, we'll pay, you know, this seven-figure amount or this eight-figure amount. And DOJ's like, oh, that's good money. That's a nice return for us on investment. Let's do that. Even though, as I've seen in some of the hospital chain cases I had, that money had already been set aside as an escrow account because they knew they were going to get caught. And it was what you said, the cost of doing business. So it had no real impact
right.
on the company itself. So there's no deterrent effect there. Right. It is money coming back to right. the programs or to the general treasury. But in terms of stopping future action, none at all.
It's like the fraud defense slush fund. Like I always joke and say, you know, I had a provider once when I was talking about doing a bunch of compliance work for them. They said, well, we didn't budget for this. And I said, well, you know, nobody budgets for the fraud, waste, and abuse issue. The only people who do that are criminals who have a lawyer on retainer for these kinds of things, but people don't really budget. But, you know, it does beg the question, because the other day on LinkedIn, somebody posted something about another provider getting a soft sentence or getting off with a settlement or whatever it was. And somebody put up a comment about how if healthcare providers got longer prison sentences, that would stop it and that would deter it. And, you know, I responded on LinkedIn and said, well, empirically, prison sentences don't have any effect on the deterrence of crime. There's just zero deterrence. And we know that from recidivism, at least in the blue collar space. But I think when we talk about healthcare, there's a little bit of a difference. And the difference in the recidivism is the fact that the collateral effects of being criminally convicted, and even sometimes in a civil settlement, but the prospect of, for example, licensure suspension or revocation by a state medical board or licensing organization, which has nothing to do with the criminal prosecution because you don't have that authority, at least in the federal space. But the fact that the collateral consequences of licensure revocation, licensure suspension, certainly a permissive or a mandatory exclusion from the OIG programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and the like, preclusion, the SAM, all of that, those are the things that have an actual effect on the deterrence of future crime in the healthcare space, because the provider of those services can't do them anymore and get paid unless they do some sort of secondary workaround, right? A shell company, work under the table, like whatever it may be. But that's going to be a huge drop versus that, you know, that norm. And so I think that the, you know, the bigger problem is that the effects of deterrence. So when we're talking about sentencing a defendant, they call them in the U.S. sentencing guidelines, they call them the 3553 factors. And those are, you know, sort of the factors for why the sentence is appropriate for what happened. And, you know, there's retribution, there's punitive, there's deterrence, right? There's all of those things. But at the end of the day, in the healthcare space, very few of those things are directly related to the sentence. You know, I mean, I love to tell my favorite story was when I did the search warrant at the podiatrist's office in New Jersey. And on his bulletin board in his office, he had newspaper clippings of two other podiatry cases that resulted in criminal prosecutions in prison. They were my cases, right? So I went in there and I immediately saw the newspaper clippings of the two cases in which both of those providers got pled guilty and went to federal prison for, you know, millions of dollars in fraud. And here I am at a third podiatrist's office, and he's got the clippings up on the wall. So, like, the deterrent factor isn't there. So, you know, like, at the end of the day, Matt, like, are corporate integrity agreements worth the juice of the squeeze? Is the time and effort spent in managing them? Or is it just like, hey, we're not going to bother giving you this corporate integrity agreement, we're not going to bother with a deferred prosecution, which is a criminal act, document. Like, just write us a check for $100 million more and let's call it a day, right? I mean, what's the point?
Right. I was with the IG for 17 years. Wade, you were there how long?
24.
Eric, you were there 25, 30 years, 100 years. How many cases did you have where the subject was violation of an integrity agreement?
Not only did I have zero, but I actually had a case where the provider was had a civil settlement and was under a CIA. And I actually had actionable intelligence to show that they were potentially violating the CIA. And it wasn't 100% sure that they were, but there certainly was the ability of somebody to want to at least put in a notice of potential breach to investigate it. But the answer is still zero. I have not seen.
You can go online. And I think all it's done is created a cottage industry for compliance officers.
Yep. And you can go online and look at cases in which there was a breach of a CIA. I mean, I think there's probably only a handful where there was a CIA breach. And the question is that when there is a breach of the corporate integrity agreement, what are we seeing as the ramifications for that? Sometimes the ramification is an extension of the corporate integrity agreement. Right. Sometimes it's a penalty, but it's not we're going to breach you and we're going to prosecute you or take our, right?
Exclude you. Yeah.
Something.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, it's they're so tightly worded to be just the specific behavior that caused the settlement or caused the, you know, whatever. Anything beyond that, whether it's, you know, a different person doing it or a slightly different methodology, oh, that doesn't fit that. You know, we have to do a second one for that and start the process over. They're indefensible.
Right. No, that's true. So, Wade, I want to go to you as we kind of wrap up here and just to kind of close this out. When you get a case like this, it's obviously frustrating. If you're the case agent and you've now seen Teva, because, you know, if you're the case agent, you get another case on the same company, it's going back to you. Right. And so, you know, to some extent, it's almost like you have to manage expectations with someone that you're, you know, you've got on your team or one of the team members is like, you know, it's Groundhog Day. Right. It really is. This is an exact example of the circus never changes. Right. Yeah. It's just the clowns. And right. So Teva's number three settlement, and in it's different behaviors, you know, each way it's different behaviors, but it's like at what point, and I think this is really the question, is from an investigator's perspective, it's like, you know, you say it's Groundhog Day, at what point, and there is none, right? But, you know, you just kind of have to deal with it and just say, like, we're here again, and then learn and share that knowledge for the next case, because as you continue to prosecute the same organization, you get better at understanding the landscape. So from an investigative perspective, these cases, when they're the same provider, kind of should get a little easier, right?
Well, they should, but you still have to, I mean, I might put another, you probably want to have the same case agent because of their knowledge that they've, you know, learned over the last 5 years they worked the case, but I would probably, first of all, I'd probably put another new agent on it just for some new blood and new ideas. But you still have the same, within all the cases are different. We've talked about this on different podcasts. Every case is different, but there are certain things that still have to be done, like that roadmap on every case. So although it would be frustrating, there's still, you know, you find out what the allegation is, what the violation is, what are the steps to, what are the elements of that crime that you're proving? What are the steps to do that? So that you really have no choice but to basically do the same thing you did on the last case, just with a new eye on, you know how the last game ended, you know how the last show ended. You can kind of keep that in mind as to, are there any other roads we can go down or angles we can take to change it? But there's certain elements on every case that just still have to be followed, even if as the case agent is going to be very frustrated and not wanting to start, you know, okay, this is going to be the next 4 or 5 years of my life, but there there's certain things that just have to be done. You can't just say, we didn't like the way the last one ended, so we're going to pass on this one. That's not an option. So some things have to be done just the same, but at least you have a new eye to hope that the end can be somewhat different.
Right. Yeah, this is, you know, seeing these settlements, it doesn't really, they're not really head scratchers anymore, because the money is the money, and, you know, it is what it is. And particularly when you've got providers out there who, you know, when they're bringing in, particularly in the farm industry, like to see a $450 million number doesn't even raise an eyebrow anymore. 20, 30 years ago, you'd be like, wow, that's a huge number. In today's world, you know, when you're seeing billion-dollar fraud cases and the like, 400, 200 million, doesn't really rattle it. But, you know, I do think it's important for the people that watch and listen to our podcast to understand that, you know, we're not trying to be overly critical, because the process is the process. But this is one of those examples where it is a challenge when you have a company like this and using, you know, the too big to fail. Like, what do you do in these instances? You know, I know, you know, when you look at people who get prosecuted criminally for things, there's oftentimes these exclusion waivers and carve outs, right? Because of the public health care issue. For example, if you're the only urologist in a 500-mile area, you know, maybe you don't get excluded, because, you know, if you go to jail, everybody gets bladder cancer, right? Or something like that. Or, you know, I know I've seen instances with providers who were in underserved rural communities and they had certain carve outs on their exclusion. So they couldn't do this, but they could do that because of the, you know, the prospect. But when you have a big pharma company or a big device company, you know, we're not excluding Stryker. You know, the maker of a million different things in the device industry. We're not excluding Teva. So, you know, the only thing to do is to continue to try to get them to be good corporate citizens through continuing to fine them and take profits away and disgorge their profits. But that's always, it's always the challenge and how to deal with them. So, you know, I think there's, you know, there are more pharma companies under corporate integrity agreements than not. You know, I looked a couple of months ago and saw most of the larger companies were under corporate integrity agreements. A lot of them, by the way, are intrinsically connected to these patient assistant foundations for the coupons and the co-pays and getting around the donation piece of it as a factor. So I think most of the companies are under some sort of corporate integrity agreement for that. So there is something, you know, to be said from that perspective. So I don't think anybody's done with them. I think that there are going to be continued cases on these, because there's just, you know, figuring out the next way to build a better mousetrap, right?
You look at the evolution of the fraud within pharmaceuticals. It used to be, you know, the pharmaceutical rep going to the provider and just basically paying them a kickback for, you prescribe my drug, I'll give you trips or I'll give you cash or whatever it might have been. Then it was, you know, they would have seminars that they would provide and conferences you could go to based on points, based on prescriptions. And there were formulas that the companies used. And as more of those things became issues that, you know, had to be settled in most of them in Boston. Now what we have are direct marketing to patients. You know, they've taken out the prescribing physician and said, now we're going to be singing songs on television about, you know, weight loss drugs and psoriasis drugs that are, and if you look at the formularies now, those are the biggest selling drugs in the industry now. And right. Because of direct marketing.
Direct now, consumer. Yep.
And that's the, you know, it's taking the doctor out of the equation, which is probably a far more dangerous thing than paying them a kickback.
Yeah. Well, I read something recently that I think the United States, and I thought it was Australia, there might have only been the United States and only one or two other countries allow direct-to-consumer marketing. You know, and now, to make it worse, when you've got the direct-to-consumer marketing and then you've got the telemed for the visits, and they're all kind of in bed with each other, like, you know, to call, see if you qualify for this drug or whatever, it's like you've taken actual medicine out of the equation entirely.
I was up late last night, and there was a commercial on for some company for Viagra and Cialis, you know, $7 for 10 of them. Here's the process. And they, you know, scan a code, you say how many you want, what dosage, And then you are screened by a doctor and qualified or not, and then they'll show you the price.
Right. Well, and you know, the insanity, not the insanity, but you know, the part of this, because there's no insurance involved, it's a cash transaction. So, you know, what are you doing? It's the question is, who's the person on the other end who's reviewing your screening form? Is it a doctor? Is it a US-based doctor even? Is it like, who is it? And I guess at the end of the day, if you're trying to get, you know, a GLP-1 med, or you're looking to get an erectile dysfunction med, and, you know, these drugs that are typically, you know, widely given, you know, hair restoration drugs, you see these commercials constantly for these things where there's no involvement. You don't speak to a doctor, and they make it so, you know, let's not have the embarrassing conversation. You know, the embarrassing conversation is, I'm bald, I'm fat, and I can't get an erection. Those are three embarrassing conversations. You don't need to have any of them anymore. You can just
not bald.
You just go out and fill out a form. But it is interesting, and that obviously is one of those pieces of the puzzle, particularly now what we're seeing. You know, again, not to go too far off topic, but the GLP-1 drugs are now being compounded. So you're getting the drugs not even from the manufacturer, you're getting them from third parties who are compounding the formula. So, you know, but because it's a cash transaction, this is entirely a moot conversation, because they're not taking a copay, they're not charging your insurance. It's a transaction between two private individuals, basically. It's like the eBay of, you know, of the pharmaceutical industry.
It's the gray market of drugs.
Right. So, yeah. So, you know, for people that watch this podcast, like, look at these press releases. Take them with a grain of salt and see what's going on in your own plan if you're on the SIU space. If you're just an interested person who reads these because you enjoy reading the fraud, waste, abuse, funny papers, understand that none of this has a deterrent effect on healthcare fraud crime. It has none. And read empirical studies that have been coming out of places like the DOJ, you know, National Institute of Justice, or whatever it's called, some of the empirical places that are out there, some of the third-party think tanks on the effects of prison sentences and recidivism, and you'll see that by and large that's not the case. But the one thing that probably is a big factor with recidivism is, if you're excluded and you can't bill, the barrier has already been put up, right? You're already in your version of prison without being.
I actually had a plea agreement rescinded because the defendant didn't realize that exclusion was going to be a ramification, and the court agreed that the effect of the exclusion was so large that you had to take that into account in doing the plea. So they took the plea agreement off the table.
Yeah, exactly. Right. The plea wasn't as bad as the ramifications of the plea.
Right. Yep.
Right. So, yeah, interesting stuff. So, you know, do your homework on these things. And, you know, hopefully when people are posting, I mean, I say this, hopefully when people are posting, they're speaking from a position of education. But it seems like there's, you know, if you're going to have an opinion, like, let it be empirically based. For prison sentences, there has been a lot of empirically based studies that show that the deterrent factor of putting people in jail for lengthy amounts of time, or any amount of time, does not have that deterrent factor. And I think we could trace back in the healthcare space that the deterrent factor comes from the inability. We've prevented someone from doing something. You can't be a recidivist if you can't do the thing, right? When you're in jail, you can't be a recidivist. So you're just shifting, right? It just shifts to when you're out. So good stuff, always.
Yeah.
Good seeing you guys, as always. Again, grab our newsletter. Comes to your inbox every Friday. Podcasts, blogs, various and sundry musings in the healthcare fraud, waste, abuse, and SIU space. Just go to our website, advisehealth.com. Sign up for our newsletter. Get this right to your inbox. We've got some great LinkedIn Lives coming up. And again, next week, 100th episode. I didn't think we'd last 100 episodes. Thanks for tolerating me, you guys. Good seeing you, as always.
You too.
Thank you all.
We'll see everybody in the next OIG Roundtable.